make a walk with me, not like you used to do. Something different, put yourself in other people's shoes. Open up your mind and open up your eyes and change your direction, change your perspective.
Thank you so much for joining us on Other People's Shoes. As you know, I am your host, Neil Matthews. Thank you so much for joining me today. Excited about today's guest. Why am I so excited? Well, let me tell you, first, before we get to that excitement, let me tell you this. If you haven't done so already, please jump right over to opspodcast.com. That is an amazing place where you can hear past, present, and future episodes. So that's cool, right? What's also cool there is you can actually leave a voicemail about what you're hearing on the show. Something you like, something you hate, something, you know, whatever, some bit of encouragement, whatever you want to do, you can do that at the website as well. So here's another thing you can do. You can jump right over to your favorite social media of choice, whether that be Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, whichever. We are under the handle OPS Podcast Show. A little different than the website, but still pretty amazing. In fact, today, speaking of social media, we're going to be talking to our guest today, who is a content and marketing editor at Moody Publishers. And he's also a social media and marketing communication consultant. Pretty cool stuff there, right? He also writes regularly for Substack newsletter and for a little publication called Terms of Service. He'll also be publishing a book by the same title, B&H Publishing, in February. Be watching for that, not only on our website, on your local bookstore. He lives currently right now outside of Nashville with his wife, Susie, their daughter, Magnolia, and of course, we cannot forget the dog, Rizzo. Help me welcome him in. He is Chris Martin. Chris, how are you today?
I'm good, man.
But Chris, getting into you, I always like to lead off every show with this question, and that's this is, Chris, what size shoes do you wear?
13, 4E. I have a very wide foot. I think I can fit into a 12 and a half, but I have a very wide foot. So if I hope to keep shoes longer than like 6 months and not like rip through them, I need to be getting a wide shoe.
So 13 wide E, is that right? Did I get that right?
4E.
Oh, excuse me. 4E.
Yeah. So you've got like D is like a standard width shoe. And then you have W, which is a wide. Then you have a 2E, and then there's a 4E. And then I think it probably even goes further than that, but I'm rocking. I'm like 6'4", built like an offensive lineman, like, yeah, I'm rocking a wide shoe.
That's so fun. And so maybe this is a really hard question for you. Maybe the hardest you'll ever have to answer, but is there a style or brand that you like more than another?
These days, yeah, my options are pretty limited. I'm a dad, so New Balance is my like go-to. They have really like they have nice wide shoes that are like great for, I don't like, I'm not a shoe guy. You know, my brother is like you. My brother is a shoe guy. I used to poke fun at him all the time. Like, I mean, like he's hitting the drops. Like he's probably got 100 pairs of shoes, collecting Jordans, you know, that sneakerhead, a proper sneakerhead. I think the only pair of Jordans I ever had was a pair of Jordan ones that were given to my parents when I was born in the hospital, like for babies. And I still have them. Actually, we put them on my daughter when she was born a couple of years ago. Yeah. So New Balance is usually what I'm rocking. Not the white dad ones, whatever that number is, not those you've seen on the internet. That's the typical brand I'm wearing. I will say I do have two pairs of shoes that are my favorite pairs of shoes I ever own, which you might appreciate this. One were the Ken Griffey Shocks. So look up and you'll like it. You'll like it because if you don't know this, there is a beautiful Carolina blue color of them, which I owned. So look up, like, if you're listening, Carolina blue Ken Griffey Shocks. They're amazing. I felt like the coolest kid in the world when I was in school. I was a big baseball fan, big Ken Griffey fan. So really cool pair of shoes. That's when Shocks were just coming into be popular. I was probably in late elementary or early middle school. Those are pretty sweet. And then also I did play basketball a bit as a kid. My other favorite pair of shoes I ever owned were the Allen Iverson zip up shoes. They're shoes that had laces like traditional basketball shoes. They're low rise though. They're not high particularly. They're kind of a mid rise, I guess. You would zip up the laces, like the laces sat under a zipper that you would zip up. And Allen Iverson, that was Allen Iverson's pair of shoes back when he was really big in, I guess, the early 2000s. So those are my two favorite pairs of shoes I ever owned back before I had to be getting them wide sizes.
I do have a shoe problem. It is bad. Christmas time, my wife and I did not exchange presents this year. I know that may come as a shock to some, but we decided we throughout the year just buy ourselves what we want. So it's just easier just to get ourselves what we wanted. So I did purchase two pairs of shoes at Christmas time. One I'm wearing currently, they are a Jordan brand. I'm really excited about them. And then the other pair was the first for me is I did get a pair of Yeezys.
Nice.
So I do have a pair of Yeezys now in the arsenal of shoes to wear. And here's the wacky part. is I wear them to work in.
Nice.
And because I have to wear all black shoes at work, I found these Yeezys, and they don't really have a tie. It's like literally a pull. Like, I don't know what Kanye was thinking, but it's like a pull and they all tighten up around my foot. It's the weirdest thing, but they're super comfy.
I don't know what Kanye was thinking circa 2015 to 2021. That's a perfect, just like, I don't know what Kanye was thinking.
And do you want to hashtag like, that right now?
I say this as a fan of Kanye's music, whether or not that makes you think more lowly or highly of me as a person, you can decide. And if
no
you
judgment.
Listen to this podcast, I don't say this as a Kanye hater, but I don't know what Kanye was thinking the way when you said that. I was like, man, what an applicable statement to so many things.
I feel like you need to hashtag that right now. So, but anyway, Chris, getting into your story, fascinating shoe talk. People are like, man, Neil, you just find a way to talk about shoes. I'm like, that's what we do. We talk about shoes, but that's not all we talk about. Of course, we do talk about other things. But Chris, I'm curious about this. I know there's a new book coming out. It's going to be really exciting. It's exciting for you probably to not only see your name in the print on the internet, but it's probably also just equally as exciting to see your name kind of in a tangible sense that you can hand out to folks, things like that. Books are kind of exciting in that way. But I'm excited about this because you're writing about, I think, something I struggle with. My hand is up. I think others' hands should be up if they're being truthful with themselves. Has social media for you been a shadow in your life? And if so, how?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I grew up with social media from a very early age. My dad worked for IBM when I was a kid, which was in the 90s when IBM was like, I mean, they're relevant today, but they're like even more like culturally relevant back then. Like they were a major player. Like, so people were really familiar with the brand, and it was a really big influence just in broader culture back then. And so I grew up, my dad worked for them and he worked from home, which today sounds pretty standard. In the 90s was super rare. In fact, a local newspaper came and like did a story on our family, like local man works from home. He's one of a million Americans who do this. His son can sit on his lap when he takes conference calls on his second landline, so he doesn't block the main landline for his wife to use. Yeah, so like I grew up with computers. I grew up with the internet. I was on AOL Instant Messenger when I was in first grade. I have just always really been there. And I think definitely like I was among the first kids, teenagers, to learn how to be a teenager with the internet in hand. Like MySpace, which is the first really popular social media platform. I mean, you had Friendster and other things before that, but MySpace was one of the first, I would say the first, like super broadly popular, hundreds of millions of users social media platform. Like I was the target audience for that. I was in like seventh grade, sixth grade. And so yeah, I mean, like I had to learn how to manage social relationships, how to learn about myself, like how to develop as a person going through the super tumultuous time that is middle school and high school, living it on stage. Now, we didn't have it in our pockets yet. The iPhone didn't come to be until I was a junior in high school. So students today are certainly dealing with a level of it that even I didn't have to deal with, but I did have social media. I mean, we were posting on MySpace and Facebook and communicating via text message and AOL Instant Messenger when I was in middle and high school. So yeah, I have plenty of like, I did plenty of dumb stuff on the internet and on social media when I was a teenager. And it's not like I don't anymore either. Like having to grow up in that environment, definitely like learn some lessons the hard way, like learn things about myself. Today, I think I definitely, in part because of maturity, in part because of experience, in part because of God's work in my life, have a much better and healthier relationship with social media and the internet than I did when I was like 16. It's hard to just like put out of your mind. I'm sure everybody has this, like how dumb you were when you were a teenager, like the foolishness that you did when you were a teenager. And yeah, like social media and the internet was like a significant part of that because it was a social playground as much as going to a school basketball game or school dance was. It was a social playground in the same way.
I think that's very fascinating to one, take that stroll down memory lane, because as you're naming things and talking about things, and that's why I love it when people bring up years, because for me, maybe others do the same. Maybe I'm just odd in this way. When you talk about a year, I try to put myself in that year. Like where was I in 2003? Where was I in, you know, such and such and such? Because I always try to put myself in that juxtaposition perhaps. But I'll tell you this, like I didn't even know what Facebook was for like a really long time. I don't know if I was one of the late comers to Facebook. I know a lot of people had it. I never had a MySpace. I do remember, you know, AOL getting the CDs in the mail and dropping them in the CD-ROM. You know, back in the day, people are like, what? CD-ROM? What are you talking about? I think most of my audience is pretty older, so most of them know. But I remember that. You know, I remember email in high high school, like coming into fruition. I remember Windows 95 being like the hottest, coolest thing ever. And I was like, what is this like ski free game? This is fun, right? I remember things like classic. That. I remember like, yeah, classic, of course. I need to find that, by the way. They need to make a Mac version of that because I'd play it all day long. But I say all that I would bet
significant money there's like a browser version of that just for
this. There's gotta be.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
There's gotta be. Yeah, okay. Because that was just with the Yeti. Okay, all right. But my whole thing is like social media for me is a love-hate relationship. And we were kind of talking about this in the green room a little bit. I feel like I have to post every day. I feel like as a content creator, as a podcast host, I have to post something every day. I got to comment on people's stuff. I got to follow people, certain people. I got to do all this. And for me, when I heard about your book from our good friend, Amber Cullum, which she's fantastic. I know you're going to be sitting with her and just excited that she, you know, kind of introduced us. When I saw your book come across my email, I was like, okay, there's so many questions that are coming to mind. Like, is social media a drug? Am I addicted to this drug? I don't want to be a drug user. I grew up in an era where we say no to drugs, where Nancy Reagan told us to say no to drugs and we had DARE and all this stuff. Is social media in your mind becoming a drug? And has it been like a drug for you in some respects?
Yeah, so I'm not a psychologist. And I should say that to start. I talk a little bit about like being addicted to social media in the book. I think there are like clinical definitions of addiction, and that's not what I mean. Though I do think that people become like clinically addicted. I'm just not the kind of person to like diagnose that, I guess you could say. Is social media a drug? For me, yeah, kind of. I think what I would say, it kind of is a drug dealer. That's how I've usually talked about it. It provides different kinds of drugs. If we see drugs as like feelings that we're given or feelings that are activated, I think social media deals different kinds of drugs depending on how we're feeling. Honestly, like a lot of people talk about how, you know, social media makes people depressed or anxious, and that's all true. And finally, some good data is starting to be published about the relationship between social media use and degrading mental health. And that's just first of all, those studies are so hard to do because so many factor. A, you need long-term studies, which social media is ever changing, and it's hard to study it over a long period of time in regard to mental health. And people's mental health is affected by so many different things that creating a causative relationship between a single variable and someone's mental health is near impossible. I've learned as I've read people who try to do studies like this. But finally, there's some good work being done to show that there is a positive correlation between more social media use and worse mental health. However, I think a lot of people don't care that social media makes them feel bad, or they care, but they can't stop using it. What social media does for them is it makes them feel something. And that is, I think, one of the most alluring parts of social media is a lot of people would rather feel bad than not feel anything at all. Sometimes social media, people interact with social media because it makes them feel good. And sometimes they interact with them with social media or their preferred platforms because it makes them feel bad. And it's not like they're trying to make themselves feel bad, but it's like, it's a different kind of high or like thrill, I guess you could say, this like feeling. And then it's like, there's like a recovery. Like, how can I recover my feeling here? How can I find, if I'm going down into a valley, how can I shoot back up into a peak, you know, mentally and mood wise? And so, yeah, I think social media could be called a drug. Some people have called it that. I think otherwise, another way of thinking of it is it's really a dispensary for different kinds of drugs, leads us down different paths of feeling, whether positive, negative, or somewhere in between.
In your mind, has it ever been a drug for you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, for sure. I think in different seasons of life, I've found, I think especially when I first kind of graduated college and was trying to find myself professionally, I was working for a really well-known Christian author and speaker speaking nationally. And I was helping him write content for his blog and write articles for major news outlets and running his social media and editing a lot of what he was writing and just kind of being his right-hand man in a lot of his work that he was working on. And I felt the need to kind of try to develop my own voice in that way. And I felt this draw to try to become influential when I was 23, 24, really getting my feet as like a professional individual adult. I would just like wade into fights on Twitter about theology or the intersection of theology and culture and try to like puff out my chest and like bang on it and say, here's the right way to think about this particular cultural thing. So for a long time, I would say 3 or 4 years, really, I would say from like 2013 to 2016, that period, I was really interested in Twitter's always been my favorite social media platform and therefore the one that I can go astray most easily on. And I would just try to like pick fights or troll people and try to try to start stuff to get attention. And finally, around 2016, I was just like, you know, no, this isn't really worth it. Like, and so like, I changed how I use social media in the last, especially Twitter, in the last 5 years, 6 years since then. Like I for a long time deleted all social media apps from my phone. And this is when I was running social media at Lifeway Christian Resources, which is one of the largest Christian resource providers in the world. I was running social media, overseeing 60 social media managers and 270 social media accounts. I deleted every social media app from my phone because I was like, I don't want to interact with this on my own time at all. Obviously, I was still interacting with it like professionally on my computer, but I was like, when I'm done working for the day, I want to make it as hard as possible for me to hop on these platforms. And so I went through that for a period, which is a kind of detox. And even today, I have time limits set on my phone for how much time I can spend on certain social media apps just to keep me from spending too much time and neglecting other important parts of my life. And also, like, I've gone through periods even recently where I'll be logged out of my personal Twitter account and have like, I'll use like an anonymous Twitter account that I created. People call it a burner, but that makes it sound like you're trying to do something shady. I'm not trying to do something shady, where like, I'm not tempted to be myself because I still like using Twitter to keep up on like sports news or video game news or other interests that I have. But I don't feel this temptation to like speak up and like get attention because nobody knows who that account is. It's just kind of more of a like reading account than a creating account. So I just try to put some safeguards in place, but it has definitely been, call it a drug, a stumbling block, a place where I can be tempted to become the hero of my own story.
I love that, the hero of your own story, because so many times I think as a guy, I think that's our tendency as guys, is we want to be the hero. We've grown up around Luke Skywalker. To your point, you know, we've grown up around the Spider-Mans, the Marvel universe. We want to be this superhero. We want to be Batman. I know he's not a superhero. I'm with you on that, by the way, as well. But we want to be, right? We want to be saving the damsel in distress. I mean, Super Mario Brothers talking about video games. I mean, that taught me from a young age, the princess needed to be saved. Never did. That, by the way, so she's still at King Koopa's lair because I could never beat Mario Brothers, but that's another story.
Sure.
But I know we talked about, you know, as part of your introduction, we talked about your daughter, that you have one. So my question is, how are you teaching your daughter about social media? And what lessons do you think other parents can maybe learn from what you're teaching? And again, I know you're not an expert per se, you're not a psychologist, but I know you've done a lot of research on social media. And I'm leaning into that expertness. From that standpoint, what would you share with that?
So our daughter's not quite two. We're not teaching her specifically about social media yet, though I do think we're teaching her with our actions, and not always in constructive ways. When I'm hanging out with my daughter in the evening, you will find me scrolling TikTok. You will. Like, it's, and sometimes you'll find her watching TikToks with me. And she's found a couple of favorite songs because of that. So yeah, but for us, like, here's a way that, regarding social media and our daughter, we decided before our daughter was born that we would not be posting any pictures of our daughter on the internet, which is kind of a controversial decision, and understandably so. But what we decided, well, I mean, there are a number of reasons, as you can imagine, being somebody who wrote a book on social media and the ways that it affects us in ways we don't realize. I have some pretty strong opinions about privacy, data privacy, things like that. There's an entire chapter on how we trade our privacy for free expression. Like, we're so interested in expressing ourselves that we'll just give away any and all information about ourselves without even thinking about it. And I think, like, the thing I thought of, and I think what kind of helped convince my wife to not be posting pictures of our daughter online, was I said, think about, like, you're a parent in 2003. MySpace is only beginning, like, not really taking hold. People are still kind of hesitant to buy things on the internet. Like, you mean I'm going to put my credit card in this website? And imagine telling a parent in 2003, hey, in 10 years, 2013, it's going to be totally normal for you to post pictures of your children as soon as they're born from the hospital, while they're playing in the bathtub, and like every day. And people will think you're weird if you don't do that. They'll think like, what are you trying to hide something? Like, do you just not want your family to see your kid? That's what it's going to be like in 10 years. That parent in 2003 would be like, you're insane. Like, who posts pictures of their kid on the internet every day? That is crazy. Like, I'm not even going to put my credit card in that thing, let alone post pictures of my kid half naked in the bathtub in there. Are you joking me? And yet here we are. We're weird. People kind of like, wait, you don't post pictures of your kid on the internet? Are you like Amish or something? No offense to the Amish. Not that they would hear this anyway, but like, are you like, you're a weirdo. And I'm like, just think about this for a second. And that's really like that whole scenario is, and I don't judge people who post pictures of their kids, like, no judgment here. It's a personal decision. But I think the fact that we went from, wow, that would be crazy, to you're crazy for not doing it in like 10 years or less, is a perfect example of how we have so uncritically embraced these platforms and have not asked any hard questions of any of these platforms at all. We just give them whatever they want. We give Instagram our locations so that we can put the temperature of the room we're in when we're posting an Instagram story. Why? What? Who cares? And do you realize what you're doing by giving that up? All I'm trying to say is, regardless of what decisions people make, those are all personal. I just want us to think, just like ask questions about, how are these platforms shaping me? What's the end goal? Like, what do I hope Instagram accomplishes for me? And so for our daughter, part of the reason is we like wanted to keep her privacy secure and as best as we can. I mean, surely like she's going to be in a wedding later this spring. A picture or two of her in the wedding is surely going to be put on the internet. That's like, there's only so much we can do. We are making concerted effort. And then also, like, I believe seriously in individual digital autonomy, which is kind of like a gobbledygook phrase, but like individual digital autonomy. I think anybody get a say in whether or not their picture is posted on the internet, you know, like consent forms and all of that. If you like go to an event, they're like, hey, your picture may be used on promotional material or whatever, you know, something like that. I think like, it might sound silly or whatever, but I think of that in regard to my daughter. Like, I don't want to post pictures of her being goofy or being silly that maybe she is embarrassed by when she's 12 or 13. Like, I just don't, I want to respect her individual digital autonomy. That's important to me. And so that's another reason, a little bit more abstract, as to why we've made that decision. So when it comes to, man, I'm really glad she's not 12 right now. I work in the student ministry at our church and have worked in student ministry since I was a student in student ministry. So like, I started like my freshman year of college and have been in a student ministry in whatever church we've been in since. I've walked through with parents, with students, like, when's the right time to get a phone? When's the right time to get social media? And man, there's not a easy answer or a right answer. And it's really hard, because not giving social media to a teenager is effectively disabling them socially. And that's a big deal. And I don't take that light, as much as I'm like, yeah, 13-year-olds should not be on Instagram, on any of these platforms, like plenty of data to show that it's detrimental to their mental health. At the same time, so is being socially ostracized. So how do we walk this line? How do we use it wisely? And my hope is, you know, in the next 10 years before my daughter's 12, and maybe we're making some more of these kinds of decisions, we have a little bit more clarity on, there's maybe a little bit more of a social understanding among parents, like, hey, we're not doing this, right? Or we're waiting, right? You know, I doubt that'll happen. We can't come to a consensus on much of anything lately. Maybe things will develop into a little bit more clarity before then.
I love your humor, but I think there's so much truth to what you're saying in your humor. Because I think so many times, I know I've been guilty of this, like the day my daughter was born, I'm sure I threw a picture on Facebook of her birth, right? That's how we made the birth announcement, right? And now my daughter's 14. And recently, I would say recently, within the last, I would say year or so, we finally caved in as parents and said, okay, you can have Instagram, but oh, by the way, we're going to be monitoring it. Oh, by the way, we're going to be reading your DMs. Oh, by the way, we're going to be, you know, keeping an eye on what you do and what you've said. And we have some software in place that have helped aid us as parents, keywords, things like that, phrasing and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, I can only imagine 14-year-old Neil in this day and age with Instagram and Facebook. Like, no.
Oh my gosh.
Like, no. But to your point, if they don't have it, they're almost socially ostracized in a lot of respects. And I love that you brought that, again, that juxtaposition. So there's a band out there I found out recently, which I feel like today years old when I found this out, that this band that I've loved for years, Switchfoot, actually covered this song for another band, which I was like devastated by. I'm like, wow, I thought John Foreman wrote these lyrics because they were so powerful. Here are the lyrics. It says, how many likes is my life worth? That's the key phrase that I want to key in on with you, is how many likes is your life worth?
Well, hopefully not many, because I don't get many. You touch on a significant point there. One of the chapters is on attention determining our worth. And I think it's one of the lies we've come to believe by uncritically embracing social media into our lives, that how much attention I get is how much I'm worth. I say throughout the book and really throughout my online writing, you know, web slinging it all over the internet, that attention is the currency of the social internet. It is the money, because frankly, we all have more money than we have attention, and we can all make more money. You could pick up an Uber gig to make more money. You cannot get more attention, because ultimately attention is just time assigned to a particular subject. And plenty of people throughout history, the richest people, have said, you know, time is more valuable than money. And attention is really just time assigned to a particular thing. And so attention is the most valuable asset on the internet. It is the currency of the internet. And the way we measure attention is through engagement. So that'd be likes, comments, shares, watch time, listen time for a podcast or whatever. And so a lot of us have come to measure our worthiness based on the metrics, engagement numbers, that show us how much attention we're being given. There's a chilling podcast from, gosh, 2015. It's an episode of This American Life. I want to say, which is a huge podcast, if you've never heard of it, from Chicago Public Radio. This American Life is the name of the podcast. The episode I want to say is like, Please Like Me. I don't remember what it's called. You can look it up. Look up This American Life Instagram and it'll pop up. But Ira Glass, the world famous show host of the show, interviews like a bunch of teenage girls, three or four teenage girls. And they talk about how, and again, this is like 2015, about how, you know, if they don't get a certain number of likes within the first 5 minutes, they just delete the photo because they're afraid of the social repercussions of not getting 50 likes in 5 minutes or whatever. And this kind of thing, first of all, let me say, it's really easy to pick on teenagers here. And sure, like, I get that. I said this on a podcast the other day, kind of controversial maybe, but I think a lot of teenagers are better at handling social media than their parents are, even though their immaturity leads them to handle it and use social media in some foolish, terrible ways. I think a lot of them understand some of the social dynamics of social media more than even their parents do. However, the social dynamics of being a teen are just exacerbated on social media. And so the whole like attention determines my value is a teenage problem, but I would say it's even beyond that. I've often joked that the way a lot of people view winning the social media game is by going viral. And like anybody who's like, I've handled social media for a number of entities over the years, both in consulting and in my day job. And every marketing manager I've ever worked with has said something to the effect of like, how can we get something to go viral? And it's like, it's every social media's like biggest nightmare and eye rolling moment. It's like a kind of a joke among social media managers. Like, oh yeah, just let me pour the special viral juice on this piece of content. We'll just make it go viral. No problem. Everybody just wants to go viral, it seems, a lot of times. And you look at like virality, the you know, the phenomenon of going viral feels like a little bit like a lottery ticket you can control. It can lead to riches and fame. Look at like Chewbacca mom. I've also, like, part of this joke is also like, you've won the social media game when you get invited on the Ellen Show or on Good Morning America, because like they, both of those programs, which like I grew up watching Good Morning America, and like my mom used to watch Oprah, which then was replaced by Ellen a number of years ago. The cultural placement for those shows, especially for a certain demographic, is incredibly important. But it's like the logical end of any viral video is to go on to like the Ellen Show. She like surprises you having you on. Wow, this is amazing. Oh, you went viral for that soup. Like an 8-year-old plays an amazing guitar solo. Wow, that's so cool. Here's Guitar Center with a $20,000 check. Go buy some new equipment. Isn't that amazing? Yay. And it's like that. Like, I actually wrote a post the other day in my newsletter. There's like, go to the Ellen Show's YouTube and just search viral in this YouTube search bar of her channel, and there's like 100 videos. So it's like a lot of people want that. It's like, that's the validation. It's the, so my life is worth something because I became famous for this goofy video of my kids or my dog or whatever else. And I think we need to get past the idea virality and attention determines value and worth. And I think, unfortunately, that's the goal for a lot of folks. My hope is that we become disenchanted with that after a while, but my fear is that a lot of people will have to learn that the hard way rather than kind of coming to a point of wisdom before they learn it the hard way.
I think this book is so relevant to so many people. I'm excited to get my hands on it as well. But for me, when I sit with authors, I'm always troubled and plagued with, because I know there's that midnight kind of typewriting session or that midnight brainstorming session as you're creating books, as you're creating content, because I'm, as a creator, I'm there too, not in the written form, but in the spoken form. But was there a really hard chapter for you to write? And if so, maybe talk about that. Like, why was it so hard to write?
Sure. Great question. I have not been asked this question. I think some of the hardest chapters to write were some of the first. So in terms of service, the whole part one is actually ended up being one of my favorite parts. But I went around and around for a while debating whether or not to even do part one the way I ended up doing it, because I wasn't sure if anybody would like it. So part one of Terms of Service is called How We Got Here. And the three chapters are, how did the social internet evolve? How does the social internet work? And how does the social internet affect our lives? And like chapter one is, how did the social internet evolve? That's kind of a history of social media, like a history of the internet from the 1980s or really 1960s and 70s to today. And like, how did we get from the internet is a digital communications platform for universities and government agencies to send information back and forth? How do we get from that to AOL was producing more CD-ROMs than anybody in the world, to MySpace peaking in like 2004 and almost buying Facebook for like $50 million and Facebook saying no. And then Facebook overtaking MySpace like 6 months after that offer, then to where we are today. That chapter, How Did the Internet Evolve? Chapter one was probably the hardest because it required just so much research. Like I fact check stuff over and over just to make sure, because so much was changing so fast. But that was just a really hard, it was a super fun chapter to write because it was fun for me to go back and like remember and learn and be reminded of, like, you know, because I was a user of MySpace and all these early platforms, but I didn't know the relationships and that these people knew each other and they hated each other or they were used to work together and then they didn't. And so it was really interesting to learn how everything evolved. And I wanted to make that a chapter to kind of set the stage for it, for where we are today. But it was definitely one of the hardest. And I don't think I wrote chapter one until close to the end of the writing process, actually, because I was so intimidated by it. And I was, I think, waffling back and forth on whether or not to do it. And is it, would people find it interesting? Am I only finding this interesting? And actually, I handed the manuscript to 5 or 10 friends before I even turned it in late 2020. And a number of people said that that chapter was their favorite. And so I was really encouraged because I was like, oh, all that hard work was really worth it. And it wasn't just me who was like nerdy interested in the history of social media. Like a lot of people are interested in kind of how we got to where we're at, especially people who grew up around the same time as I did. If an 18-year-old picks up the book, they may not, first of all, I'd be honored, but secondly, they may not find it as interesting as maybe like you and I who were among the development of so many of those platforms. So I think chapter one is probably the hardest. It was not the first that I wrote, but it was, I think I would say, the most work.
I love that because I think so many times as an author, right, you want to highlight the maybe prettier parts of a book or prettier parts of the story. I mean, we all love that feel good underdog story. I mean, Kurt Warner's story comes to mind. The Hoosier stories come to mind. There's so many great underdog stories in sports that we can gravitate around. I mean, the 2017 North Carolina Tar Heels is another great redemption story. Am I homering right now? Maybe I am. I love the fact that you really kind of had to struggle through something, because to me, again, I think it just adds to the element of the story and element to the creative process. But I'm sure you know this, but maybe our listeners don't. If Facebook were a country, it would be which number in the world? Do you know this?
Oh, man. I don't know off the top of my head. Do you know it?
So I had to Google it. So if Google's right, this is as of 2016. So obviously a little back data on this, but they rank it as, if it were a country population-wise, it would be the number one country in the world, population-wise.
Oh, yes. Yes. I was thinking GDP in worth.
Oh, yeah. As far as economy goes? Oh, I didn't go there. I just went straight population.
Yeah. Facebook is the largest population. I'm not surprised by that. And I probably would have guessed that if I was thinking population in terms of worth, because this is what I just Googled. If Facebook were a country and it had a GDP, a gross domestic product, I think is the acronym. First of all, its nominal GDP, if it were a country, or its market cap, because it's a company, is $763.5 billion. And it would be the 26th richest country in the world.
26th richest country in the world.
That's right. Yeah. A country. It's ahead of Switzerland, Turkey, and a number of others. So wild.
That is wild to think about. Yeah. And now you throw an Instagram on top of that, right? Or are those numbers combined, do you feel like?
I think they should be combined because Facebook owns Instagram.
Because they are one entity now, Instagram and Facebook.
That's right. That's right.
But if you could go back in time, jump in that proverbial DeLorean with me, and you know now in 2022, what would you tell that 2003 Chris, that version of you in 2003 about social media?
What would I tell 2003? Well, I would jokingly say invest in Facebook. I invest in a number of tech companies. I don't invest in Facebook on principle, but I would jokingly tell myself to invest in it. I would say to that kid, you can use it. Don't fall for its tricks. Like, don't understand that you're being used by it as much as you are using it. And I think that that kind of goes with something that I'm passionate about today is, you know, these social media platforms are given to us ostensibly as tools for us to use to improve our lives in one way or another. And I think we have come to be used by social media platforms as much as we use them ourselves. And I would say teenage Chris, high school Chris, was definitely uncritically embraced all of the platforms that were coming about at that time, which were really just MySpace and Facebook. Instagram didn't come out till I was in college, and I was never super into Instagram. Twitter and Facebook and MySpace, I just use them without thinking. I look back on the Facebook memories from time to time today of things I posted in 2007. And man, I just cringe. Like I look at Facebook messages because Facebook messages are still around from like when I was in high school. I just cringe. And it's like, I almost want to like go back and apologize to some people who I was just like totally cringe to, or like a jerk to when I was like 16 and 17 in Facebook messages or whatever. And it's just like, who was I? It feels like, I mean, and truthfully, like I grew up in the church, but I really don't think I took faith seriously or really was probably saved till my junior or senior year of high school. So a lot of that stuff, it's like, yeah, I am kind of a totally different person, not only because I matured, but really I would say that I met Christ. You know, I would say I knew Christ, but I was not following Christ until late in high school. So it's, I look back at that stuff and I'm like, man, that's not the same person. And so yeah, I would say, you know, don't get played by these platforms and keep them at an arm's length, I guess is the best advice I would give myself. I don't think 13-year-old self would care to listen to current self unless like I was a known time traveler, in which case like probably I would. But I do think that, I think that's probably what I would say. Yeah.
It's interesting that you use the word follower of Christ after we're talking about social media. I'm trying to be funny in my own little ways, but I get what you're saying there. So Chris, how can people get a hold of this amazing book that you've created? Let's tell them how they can do that.
Yeah, sure. So you can find Terms of Service, the book, anywhere you want to buy books, I think. Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Amazon, Lifeway's website, Christian Books website. I think just about anywhere you want to buy books, you should be able to find. I think some Christian bookstores are picking it up. I asked my friend who actually runs a Christian bookstore the other day. I was like, hey, you told me you're going to buy copies of my book for the store. How many are you buying? He was like, probably like two. I'm like, yeah, that sounds about right. So if you have a local Christian bookstore, they may have it, that you may be able to get them to order it for you, but it'll be on the big boys too, the Amazons and all of that kind of stuff. And you can find it there. And if you are looking for other things or whatever, termsofservicebook.com, I think is a site set up specifically for the book. So you can find other options there and such if you need. But yeah, and if you ever like, seriously, if you read the book or you're wondering about the book, you have any questions, I'm on Twitter at ChrisMartin17. And that's, again, I think I mentioned toward the beginning, like that's my primary social media platform. I maintain a Facebook presence, but occasionally connect with family there or whatever. So Twitter is where I like to engage with folks who maybe are interested in the book. So if you find yourself interested, or you read it and find it helpful, you read it and you don't find it helpful, I'm always open to be hearing from folks who want to chat about these topics. And at ChrisMartin17 is where you can find me there. So,
Chris, you did forget one place where the book will be featured. So can I help you with that?
Please.
Okay. So we're going to be featuring it on opspodcast.com/books that I love. So it'll be up towards the top, not the tippy top.
All right.
That is reserved for two amazing books. So if you're wondering what those amazing books are, you'll have to go check out that there. We will feature it there. And so folks can go there as well if they didn't grab all that information that you were just sharing. So we like to play this game called Senseless at the end of our show. So it's just six random questions. I have a cup here. Do you have a North Carolina one? Just happen to be hanging around here. So I'm going to use that one. Are you okay if I roll on your behalf?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, good. Because it'd make it really hard to get a cup back to you to roll. But all right, here we go. I'm going to roll for you. And you got this question here.
Okay.
Which is number three. Yes, the die is also a North Carolina die. So it's funny how that works out. So question number three is this. What is your favorite thing to smell?
Oh, this is the easiest question I've ever been asked. Yankee Candle, apple pumpkin scented Yankee Candle. There's nothing else like it. Don't get cheap ones. Don't go to Walmart and get something, some knockoff piece of junk. Don't go to Kroger, get some knockoff piece of junk. I need all of you who are listening, come July, early August, go on to Yankee Candle. They'll have like a 3 for $2 deal or something like that. And buy the giant jar of apple pumpkin Yankee Candle, and not spice pumpkin, not some other apple stuff, apple pumpkin Yankee Candle. It is fall in a jar. It is majestic. It will transform your fall experience and make it the most wonderful time of the year. Apple pumpkin Yankee Candle, hands down. I usually buy 3 or 4 a year. My wife just rolls her eyes because I blow through them. They're on 24-hour, not really, eight, however long I'm awake, they're on. And it's like the first time it drops below 55 degrees here in Nashville, fire it up. Let's go. So anyway, That's what I would say. Easiest question ever. Good question.
Yankee Candle is not a sponsor of the show, but all of a sudden I'm getting emails left and right for them. I don't know why, but there we go. Chris, you're fantastic. I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate what you shared. I love the fact that the book is going to be out. I love the fact that we're able to feature it on our set as well. So if you're curious about what we're talking about, you probably need to rewind a little bit because we shared some really amazing stuff today. So Chris, thanks again for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Guys and gals, kids and campers alike, I don't know about anybody else. I am a social media junkie. I'm sure I'm the only one. I'm the only one walking in these shoes right now, right? I'm the only one in the New Balance shoes that Chris so eloquently described for us. I'm the only one wearing those, right? No, I'm not. In fact, I know I'm not. In fact, studies and statistics show that I'm not. So here is my challenge for you this week as we wrap up. I'm going to do it. I'm going to ask you to do it as well. I'm going to go a week without social media. I'm going to delete the apps from my phone. That's Twitter. That's Instagram. That's Facebook. Chris has convicted me to do that. He never said I had to, but I think he strongly encouraged me to do it. So I'm going to do it for a week. I'm going to ask you and I'm going to challenge you to do the same thing, which is going to be weird because we usually highlight the guest on the show. So for a week, we're going to have like maybe a double post. Like we're going to have Chris's episode and then we're going to have the guest after him. But I'm going to challenge you in this because I think right now, more than ever, we need to connect on a real authentic level. Who's with me? If you are, don't let me know on social media. Open your email and you can email us at opspodcastshow@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you that you took our challenge of a week of fasting from social media and really connect with people on an authentic level. Let me know how that goes for you. I'd love to know. Just remember this as we wrap up today. Do not ever forget. Remember this. Remember, when you walk in other people's shoes, you really do get a different perspective on life. Thank you so much for listening and stay tuned until next week when we walk in other people's shoes.